My name is Donna. I'm the Spiritual Programs Coordinator for Kadapa Center. Mm-hmm. And really appreciate you all coming for the class, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Now that it's the last night of the class, I'm sure that you have talked a little bit about karma, sort of the natural law, what goes around comes around. And, of course, in Buddhism, one of the lessons we take from that is if we want certain things to happen, we try to create the cause for it to happen, try to send it around so it'll come back around. And so we at Kadapa Center, we really cherish these teachings, and we cherish the people who give of their time to offer the teachings. And so as our part of sending it around so it'll come back around, today we have a little offering for our teacher in gratitude to him for teaching the class. So thank you, Steve.
Aren't you special?
I would also encourage you, if you've enjoyed this class and you want to go a little bit deeper, there is another course called Discovering Buddhism, and it runs on Monday nights, and it's on a 2-year cycle, and we're just about coming to the end of this cycle, so it's going to be starting up again. It's a long time from now. It's in January, but you can start right at the very beginning and come into the class. We're just finishing up. Next week we'll be finishing up the module on transforming problems. And after that is the module on Tantra, which might be a little bit woo, if you've just taken the nutshell course. But you're welcome to come to any of the classes, because if it doesn't make sense to you now, just put it on the shelf, and, you know, it'll make sense later on as you go along. But it will be starting up again in January. There's also a meditation class, Meditation 101, which we should be offering Tuesday nights. But not right away. I'm sorry. I'm the Spiritual Programs Coordinator, and I don't even know what our programs are. but it will be coming up soon. And I guess that's the end of my advertising for tonight. So thank you all for coming. Yes?
The Monday night class, mm-hmm. What time does it start?
It's the same as this. The Monday night Discovering Buddhism also runs from 7 to 8:30. The transforming problems, actually, next week it's going to run from 6:30 to 9 because it's the last day of the class, and so they'll do some practice, they'll do some meditations. But again, you're welcome to come if you want to. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
Testing. There we go. Just to calm ourselves and place ourselves in the room. So if you'll get into your meditation posture and sit just a little forward in the chair, right hand in your left hand, your spine straight, jaw relaxed. And breathe through your nose. Try to make it to 5. Welcome to the last night, fifth session of Buddhism in a Nutshell at the Kadapa Center. So it's not so nice to have Donna come by and visit these classes. She's the spiritual program coordinator at Kadapa, and she organizes all these classes, all the teachers, both visiting teachers and student teachers like myself, and then the teachers that we have here. She's here almost every day, if not every day. So it's always nice to see Donna. So this last night, we're going to talk about the Buddhist theory of relativity. It's this emptiness. This is a unique topic to Buddhism. Emptiness is was the original topic that the Siddhartha Gautama presented to his students. Other traditions, other topics in Buddhism, karma, rebirth, and so many other things similar to that were practiced in the other traditions that were found in India and in Asia at that time. Emptiness refers to an absence of inherent existence. And I've got a short video we're going to watch, but we need to talk about it a little bit because the video, while it's certainly entertaining, can go over your head. What does that mean? Are there fantasies in your life? I mean, so we look in the mirror and we see our reflection in the mirror. We know that's just a reflection. We know that's not real. We don't think about that though. I mean, when we see our reflection in a mirror, we're not thinking, well, that's not real. That's just a representation of what I look like. Are there other fantasies in our life? I was thinking of one actually. Chris, I saw this Jerry Seinfeld thing the other night. He was talking about disappointment. The example he used was a cereal box, and this sits home with me. But anyway, so the toys they used to put on cereal boxes, they put a picture of a toy. It's like, I remember there was one, a frog man. You know, it was this really cool looking frog man, you know, diver, and he's going through the kelp and the sea floor, and there's big shells, and I mean, it's like, oh man, you know, and you tear off the top and you're digging through the cornflakes and squishing everything up to get that. Man, that's the sorriest excuse for a toy. I mean, it was so much fun. That was so exciting, you know, the anticipation. I probably even talked your mother into buying it at the grocery store because of that picture of that frog man. And then you get home with it and it's like, really? But I mean, in our life like that a lot? I mean, then there are a lot of things we see that we misinterpret, that we think exist the way they appear, and then we find out that they don't. And isn't that true about a lot of things? And we talk about our relationships with people sometimes. You know, you get that perfect boyfriend or that perfect girlfriend, you think, well, this is going to make my life complete. I'm happy now. Until. I mean, hundreds of stories about how that goes wrong. And so this is what we're talking about the issue that the Buddha is describing is that we misinterpret the source of our happiness. And this confusion, this illusion that we are experiencing on how things exist is the root of our suffering. And we're talking about, if you remember when we went through the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth was the truth of the path, the truth of sensation. That's what an understanding of emptiness is. And we talked about how these things all relate. Four Noble Truths, karma, our consciousness, our thoughts, all comes back to how things exist, this idea of emptiness. Inherently means that it exists on its own, that there's something that exists on its own. And so we're talking about the two truths, the ultimate truth and conventional truth. The conventional truth is what you see. You know, this way we believe that we exist. these five aggregates. That is the way the Buddhists say we exist. It's a, and there's a slide in there somewhere. I worked on this afternoon. Any questions about that? I'm just laying a foundation for this video. Yeah, if the ones that, those of you that were here last week saw a portion of this same video, it's about 10 or 15 minutes. Richard Gere is in this video. He's a, let's see if I could get my mouse to. See this little kid sticking out his tongue. That's a tradition where they show that they're not possessed. There's these fables about if you're possessed, your tongue turns black, and the kids stick their tongues out at each other to show that they're not.
Teachings on emptiness are complex and difficult teachings, not easy to understand. It's particularly important that one prepares the mind before listening to these teachings with an appropriate motivation that opens the mind to being able to understand and absorb them. This is similar to tilling the soil of a garden in order to be able to plant the seeds of enlightenment. Therefore, now, in your mind, make a strong determination, generate a strong motivation to be able to traverse the spiritual path, to understand the Buddha's teachings on emptiness, in order to free yourself from the bonds of samsara, and to reach enlightenment in order to be able to also free all suffering living beings.
So Loma Zupa Rinpoche is only on here 2-3 minutes. His English is very difficult to follow, but they have a subtext, subtitles up there. So just bear with him. And he's going to be teaching in North Carolina next, I think, May.
Doesn't exist there in that person the way we perceive it. So when you experience the emptiness again, the mind becomes very happy and relaxed. And the same when we analyze ourselves, you know. If we are in a state of attachment and greed for something, then one can analyze, where is this greedy me? You know? How, you know, where does this greedy me exist? How does it exist? And then you try to look. Is it my body? Is it my mind? I know, you try to investigate, where is this greed in me? Is it oneness with my mind? Am I greed? Am I in the nature of greed? Can't be, isn't it? Because then you would have to be greedy all the time. So I'm not my greed. My greed is just a moment, state of my mind. Okay? So who is greedy? You know, when you research inside, you can't pinpoint this independent self that is sitting there somewhere being greedy. It's completely not there. Again, emptiness, you know, space. It makes you feel heavy. Suddenly, greed is gone because there's nobody there being greedy. And you know, the emptiness is the ultimate method to eliminate negative states of mind. Because they are based on false views, you know. When you research the correct view of the self, negativity goes, definitely goes. It has no foundation. It drops down, and wisdom comes. You know, with wisdom, this negative state of mind doesn't have a chance. And with wisdom, you feel satisfied. It satisfies you, makes you content, feel good inside. That's the ultimate solution to attachment and to, you know, negative states of mind. And this all has to be learned in meditation. So it's all part of meditation practice. But don't think that there are no methods to overcome negativities. In Buddhism, plenty of methods. It's just a matter of we need to practice it, you know.
Oh my God, chucking that with a bath water.
We go too far. We have these two extreme ways of thinking. So we either cling to everything as being having an inherent eternalistic nature. Now, interestingly, philosophically speaking, Buddhism would say that Christianity and Hinduism and Islam have this view. Just talking philosophically, not being sectarian here. Okay? Have the view of real solid self-existence something, real solid self-existence out there God, real solid self-existence soul. Buddhism would assert that it's not possible to be this. Buddhism would argue with the Christian and say, you've got the wrong end of the stick. Yes, there's God, but Buddha, but it's interdependent, everyone can become it, like I was saying before. This is a philosophical discussion. And that the view we have of self-existent God out there, of soul and absence, permanent and inherent, is a product of this fundamental ignorance that posits that, therefore doesn't see this. So these two extreme views we have, either the nihilistic one, tucked maybe out with the bathwater, or, oh, grass, you know? And these are the instinctive ways that our mind thinks now. So that what Buddha said is there's this view that ultimately there is no glasses. But the more you understand how there is glasses conventionally in its appropriate way, the more you get to this empty. And the more you realize how there is no glasses from its own side, the more it helps you understand conventional. Okay. The shorthand for conventional reality is dependent arising. That means it's a dependent arising. It arose in dependence upon causes and conditions. Now, karma is causes and conditions for me. Right now, because of ignorance in my mind, I cling to and believe in a self-existent, real, solid, out here, schizophrenic, separate, made by somebody else, hopeless, victim, meanness, which gives rise to attachment, anger, and pride, and jealousy, and all the stuff, right? All coming from this fundamental ignorance, this fundamental misconception, that is the exact opposite of the truth, but I'm a completely interdependent scenario. So because everything is empty, there can be even karma. Therefore, there is no real glasses. Therefore, there is no real demeanor. Self-existent, solid, poor, victim, mean, nasty, horrible, dangerous. They are the creation of ignorance.
Existence.
Therefore, it's simple, you see. Therefore, things are not independent. Therefore, things are dependent and interconnected. All things are connected, you know. So, the vision that comes to see selflessness or emptiness or voidness immediately experiences, so we can feel these things with direct and unmediated knowledge, immediately feels our connection with all things. So, why would I think about harming another person? He's me, you know. Why would I think about chopping down that tree? It's me, you know. So, it's in our relationship with all other things, you know. And this is, compassion springs from this. There's no way to hold it back.
We're going to listen to one student and then we'll go back to our discussion. This next student, it's interesting.
On a conceptual level, I think it's really important to explore the nature of emptiness from a logical point of view. It's impossible that we exist in our own separate islands and that we exist from our own side totally. We are dependent arisings. Everything about us is dependent on a previous moment and dependent on causes and conditions. And that's the same with everything supposedly out there is also not there from its own side. It's not powered from purely its own side. It has no concrete longevity to it. We're all in process. We're all on a prior cause. We're all in movement, moving to a new effect, which is the cause of the next effect. There's nothing concrete about any of this. And the appearance of concreteness is ignorance. That's the thing we're fighting. Now, the essential antidote to that is to at least have a strong belief in emptiness. Things are empty of inherent existence. They're empty of that solidity. They're empty of a meanness. A you-ness, an I-ness. And you take that, as His Holiness says, you take the mantra of me, I out of the mental sphere, has an incredible transformative effect. Also, you start to understand the interconnectedness of all things. Even at the simplest level, there's nothing that we see around us that we did totally ourselves. Now, being able to detach a little bit, having some experience of emptiness, even if it's imaginative, you can detach from that kind of a identification with emotion and with mindsets that create a kind of static solidity to all events and situations. So clearly, as an actor, I've got to be able to do that all the time, moving in and out of seemingly operatic, emotional, and conceptual situations, and try to maintain a sense of cleanliness about it all. That it is, in the end, just a narrative. It's just a story. And the story comes, and it goes. But that space that it emerges from remains. That is solid. And that's that space of openness and clarity. Knowing is uncontained. There's no center, there's no boundaries. So, but again, the more that you're able to see this kind of dreamlike, illusory nature of this narrative that kind of emerges and intoxicates us in kind of mysterious, magical ways, you can see that for what it is. At the same time, generating a stability. Other space, which is much more expansive and certainly loving, life's problems tend to fall away.
Questions? Yes, please.
With the dependent arising, I'm assuming then there's no free will?
Yes. Oh, yes. Good question. I cut you off. Go ahead. Is that it? So most people have that question during the karma, because they think, because in the discussions of karma, we're all, everything is karma. Free will, what you do with your body, what you say, what you think, is the cause for your future suffering or happiness. What you're experiencing today is the karmic imprints from your previous experiences. So free will is certainly still with us. Well, thank you for that. That usually comes up with during the discussions of karma. So it might be helpful. So in Geshe Searing, when he teaches this topic, this subject, we started out with, what is it that we're negating? What are we refuting? What are we saying doesn't exist? So Geshe Gaelic, one of the examples he gives when we're trying to sort out what it is that we're negating, what it is that self, the self that we're saying doesn't exist, the example he gives is with that you're at the edge of a cliff or top of a building and you're falling. That sense. Because you don't think, well, it's my aggregates falling. It's my compositional factors that's falling. You know, it's not, my consciousness is not falling. I'm falling. So the implication here is that our assumption about how we exist is a fallacy. And that we don't exist the way we think we do. This I, this me-ness that they're talking about does not exist. Here we have one, Hitty.
So I have a few questions.
Go ahead.
And I'm sorry, this is my first class.
Welcome. Sorry.
So even if your aggregate is falling, your consciousness is experiencing that sense of falling, right?
Yes.
I mean, you can't have that awareness of it unless your consciousness is there.
Yes.
But, I mean, if we're not real, then, like, how does karma exist? Because I had a past life, and so the thoughts and actions from my past life are creating the karma I'm experiencing from this life.
Correct.
So if I'm not real, how is my karma occurring?
So we're not saying, the Buddha's not saying you don't exist, you do exist. Conventionally you do. Of course you exist. But it's a label. What is your name?
Neely.
Chris wants to add something. So it's this base, this label, Neely, that you're attached to and that you're assuming exists independent of any cause, any prior cause, that you exist without prior conditions. It seems as though we're existing without change, that we're existing just the way we appear. So what your question is a description of nihilism, where nothing exists. The other extreme is what we're talking about, this falling off a cliff, this other extreme that you exist the way it appears you do. And we're going to talk for a while, maybe it'll... Chris?
Yeah, you got it there. It's not that we don't exist. We do exist conventionally, but we think, like Steve said, that we exist independent of everything else, like they said in the video. Dependent arising. We're totally, totally, totally dependent on other things. That's why we're here. Like every molecule of carbon in your body right now went through a worm at some time. That's the one that got me. Or when I was having a hard time dealing with emptiness, anyway, my wife said, look at it this way. We're all made up of parts. And Steve will probably get to this, that everything exists as parts and causes and conditions. That's the dependent arising part. And then the one that gets us and leads to big confusions, I think, is our perceiving mind. Like that pillow right there, it's made up of all the parts of the pillow and all of the people who made all the parts of the pillow and the pillow itself. But then you still have to have my mind that looks at it and labels it as pillow. Is that...
that at some point,
there had to be a beginning. I mean, I'm not saying this, what they're saying isn't right. I'm just not understanding.
Well, that's another thing. I don't know if we've gone over this in the class, but in Buddhism, the universe has always existed
okay.
and always will exist.
Okay.
So there is no beginning, and your consciousness goes back and back and back and back. Yeah.
So you're at a disadvantage being the first night. So, and what Chris is referring to is in Buddhism, there is every moment of consciousness is preceded by a prior moment of consciousness and without it beginning or end. So to illustrate what Chris is saying, so while he was talking, I made this. And, yeah. So, what I mean, to play along, what is that?
A paper airplane.
A paper airplane. Now what is it?
Ball.
Just open that up, Chris, if you will. So, and what Chris is doing is putting it back into its original form, which was a sheet of paper. So what happened is our mind labeled the form of that paper airplane. And then our mind, our labeling mind, projects attributes to that form. And the same thing with the ball. But in essence, it was just a sheet of paper. And then if you look at that even further, that sheet of paper is just celluloid. And then if you look further than that, then you get into atoms and quarks and so on. Yes, ma'am.
Well, the way I've look at emptiness is me, like on another person, is projecting like that person's bad. And instead of just saying that is a person and there was a bad thing that would happen, is that kind of getting more at it?
Yeah.
Because 5 months from now, I could say, oh, that's a great person because the moment's changed. Does that have something to do with it?
Everything has changed.
Yeah,
everybody that you know now previously was a stranger. You had no idea who they were.
Yeah.
So see, things change. Your perceiving mind can look at them, label them differently.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because of the impermanent nature of things, it doesn't exist the way we perceive them?
Yes.
And so...
Say it again.
Because of the impermanent nature of things, they don't exist the way we perceive them through our senses.
Because they're changing.
Because they're impermanent.
Yes.
So is the point that we are just consciousness?
No. No. We're just talking about how things exist. This is the last night and on this introductory course of Buddhism, and you're asking questions that go way beyond what this course is capable of doing. But what we're in this topic, what we're trying to convey is from the Buddhist perspective, things do not exist the way we all assume that they do, and it goes to this ego. This is not the best slide. And I was thinking, I'm not sure what I was thinking when I wrote this. Let me see what we come to. Here we go. So again, we're projecting attributes, and we do it not just with things, but with people. It's like, I mean, we would call this a table, but it's more accurately tabley wood. It's more accurately trees and foresters and carpenters. It's in the form of what we all agree is table. The form table. But if we took this all apart, where did the table go? I mean, this is a classic example. We all know what that is. And if we deconstruct it, and we start, and we take all these off. I mean, is that still a flower?
That's the parts of a flower. Yeah. The thing
Say it again. So where did the flower go? I mean, it's not a trick. It's not a mind game. It's just that it's an example of how we label things based on the form, based on how things are put together, and then we project attributes based on that label, based on the label that we give that form, and none of it is true. Is that a bad explanation?
Everything is dependent arising, you know. That.
And it's the root of our problems, because of our labeling minds.
The biggest problem is labeling ourselves, and we think that there's a solid Chris here, independent of everything, but no, like I said, every part of who I am and what I am and the cause and conditions to put it all together, and then perceiving mind, you still need that part, or otherwise I'd just be a bunch of carbon atoms and nitrogen and oxygen. Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead.
Well, I think the way I kind of understand it too is when I was 21 years old, that was a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm not that person anymore, any more than I was, like you said, from yesterday. Okay. You know, but I guess how I react to whatever's out there, I can have a better control over that by realizing what's real and what's not.
I heard it said in the video that realizing that you're dependent on everything, that's why you wouldn't chop down that tree. I never heard that one before. But really, that tree, since we always existed, and since all those carbon atoms had to come from someplace, they obviously went into some other previous existence of us. Yeah.
And then our interaction with other things, that's how we develop this sense of self, is other people's opinion of us and our interaction with both people and things. Yes, sir.
Two questions.
Yes, sir.
The first one is more to see if I'm thinking about it the proper way. So if karma and actions and thoughts will pretty much determine how we are, the physical form we take on the next life, whether a person, an animal, or something else, then the consciousness itself, it's completely independent from karma.
Yes.
Okay. Number two, who was the Australian nun that was shown in the video? That was very energetic.
Oh, Rubina, Venerable Rubina. She's taught here, and she is just like that in person.
Go
ahead, Eddie.
I've got a public service announcement, and that is I just heard tonight that Robina is coming next summer, like a year from right now. And she is worth seeing,
yes.
I can tell you.
Yes.
She's coming here?
Yes.
She's coming here. She usually comes here about once a year. And she just hasn't been here this year, but she's been invited back for next summer, so next August she'll be here.
She taught, when I took Discovering Buddhism, she was here during our emptiness class, and so she taught one night of our emptiness class. Chris was here. You remember that far?
You said that Lama Zorba Rinpoche is coming to North Carolina.
He's doing the Light of the Path in May.
Yeah, the Light of the Path is like starts around the 5th of May and it goes until about the 30th, and it's in Black Mountain at Blue Ridge Assembly. So there'll be as planning goes on, there'll be announcements about it on the website and at the center. But we're just in initial planning stages right now.
It's a two-week teaching. Teaches every day for 2 weeks.
I think it's closer to 3.5 because it's almost, it starts the 5th of May and it goes till the 30th or something. So it's going to be 3.5.
Profound.
A few years ago, there was a...
there we go. I mean, so all the folks at home were wondering what Professor George is asking.
Hello. A few years ago, in Washington, there was a teaching with the Dalai Lama and other folk. Is that ever coming back to the United States, or?
I don't know. He was supposed to be here. He was supposed to visit Raleigh, and he's not coming. We don't know. We weren't told why.
Okay.
Do you know something, Eddie?
Yeah.
I think his doctors have advised him not to travel internationally so much anymore, and I think probably he's not ever going to come back to the U.S. is my sense. I mean, he's well into his 80s now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was last year, because they canceled it last November or something, and they said his doctors had advised him not to travel. But
yeah, we cleaned.
Maybe he'll get healthy again.
We painted the parking lot. There we did. Yes, ma'am.
Just a quick question. I heard the word samsara.
Yes, ma'am.
What is that?
Samsara is a Sanskrit word. It means cycle. To cycle, and in Buddhism, it's the cycle of endless cycle, involuntary, as Chris would say, birth,
uncontrolled,
involuntary, birth, old age, sickness, death, birth, old age, sickness, death. An enlightened being would be able to control that, I guess the inference, samsara. So and there's a deliciousness about samsara. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that we are attached to pleasures. Now, that's different than enjoying things, but where we attach to things and assume that that's the source of our happiness, the things that we're attached to. It's what that...
Uh-huh.
Bodhicitta?
Yeah, bodhicitta. What can I...
Bodhicitta is the altruistic wish to become enlightened to benefit all others. It's that is what makes this Mahayana tradition. Let's see what else we got. So this is where, this was what was unique when Buddha was teaching. Yes, ma'am.
Oh,
yes, George.
I've got hundreds, which is why I'm anxious for the Discovering Buddhism class. So, consciousness does not arise independently from physical being.
It is not physical.
And is that therefore why consciousness is not connected to karma?
It is.
It is connected.
Yes.
So then, when we reincarnate...
Well, so that's two terms. Rebirth and reincarnation are two different. Reincarnation implies that George is going to be reborn George.
Right.
And rebirth is just that most subtle level of consciousness.
Which does not include memories or...
Vaguely, so the people that have memories of prior births are usually children,
mm-hmm.
and as they age, that memory fades. They don't remember.
There's
and it's
like
not that they remember. Right. It's not that they don't remember great details, but they do remember, you know, they remember, like His Holiness remembered the rosary, he remembered a cane, he remembered all these items. Of course, as he got older, he didn't remember any of it. I mean, he didn't remember remembering.
Okay.
So, well, this was Professor George.
Emptiness does not mean nothingness.
No, okay. That's nihilism.
Okay.
And there was a school prior to, after the Buddha passed and people got together, students, and decided and studied and debated what he taught, there was a school that arose called Chittamatra. Chittamatra posited that things only existed if there was a consciousness to observe them.
Right.
So if there was not a consciousness to see a thing, the thing didn't exist. And of course,
tree falls in the woods.
Exactly. And of course, we know tree falls in the woods, and that creates pressure in the oxygen in the atmosphere, and, there's that pressure is sound, and so we know that that does happen. So and then the other extreme, of course, is what we say, what people think how we exist, and what we end up with is the Mandimaka, which is where we are, the middle school, is that the nihilists are wrong, the Chittamatra are wrong, things do exist even though there's not a mind to observe them, and then the other extreme being that we think things exist inherently without a prior cause and condition. So Mandimaka is where we are, in the middle. Okay. So in this idea of self, I'm not Atman means no self, no soul. And this was profound for the people during the Buddhist times, it's profound for people now. These five factors that are always changing are the aggregates and how we do exist. So there's a form, the feelings, the sensations, anger, like, dislike, you like blue, I like green, those issues, perceptions, these mental formations, our intentions, these volitions, compositional factors, and then the consciousness. So I took Kondala home after a teaching, and when she got out of the car, I said, "Be careful crossing the street." And she said, "Yeah, I don't want my aggregates to get run over." But she was going to the extreme to keep from saying, and she was teaching me, I don't want to get run over. You know, I'm saying, be careful crossing the street. She was like, "Yeah, I don't want my aggregates to get run over." So here's a more detailed explanation. And if you email me, I'll send you these slides, and so you don't have to take notes. Yes, ma'am.
The Buddha taught that people don't have a soul?
Yes.
Okay.
No soul. It's this. So these perceptions that we have, we formulate an opinion about objects and experiences. These mental formations, the conditioned responses that we have of our interaction with objects. And this has a moral dimension.
Can you give an example?
The moral dimension?
Yeah, the mental formation.
So you could be mindful, a sniper. Control his breathing. Slow his heart rate so he can pull the trigger and hit another person. So that's non-virtuous. That's unskillful. That's not what these teachings are about. This is not how these teachings are to be used. You could, yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, so you're saying that slowing down the breathing, paying attention, the condition response.
Sure.
To be a sniper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm using an example of what the moral a moral aspect of that would be is how someone would use that to kill another person. So that's the moral underlying. So this is even when in secular training in mindfulness and secular training, they posit that ethics and morality is a necessity of mindfulness. It's the Jim, you want to add anything?
No, I think, you know, that, like you said, the mental formation in that case, in, you know, the case that
Steve mentioned, you know, it's a negative. But in other conditioned response, if you see somebody starting to fall and you try to catch them to help them, you know, that has a moral dimension to it too, but it's on a positive side. So, you know, there's the formation of what you're going to do and, you know, again, your intention. And that's where you get the moral dimension from.
And if you notice, even in these videos that I was showing, somebody comes on, in this case it's Venerable Connie Miller, to talk about the motivation for that particular teaching. And we do that. That is our tradition, that we set our intention before a class, and then at the end of a class or practice, then we dedicate that, whatever merit. So that's... Oops. So we get back to and it's, you know, like the airplane, paper airplane, and like these parts here, it's this label that we act like is real. I mean, we go through these exercises of trying to find the I, and so I don't know if that was Venerable Rudina was talking about, but so we go through this practice. I mean, it's like, is it in my arms? Is it in the brain is just a computer. It's just a storage. So that's not consciousness. So, I mean, they say it's not findable. I mean, I've gone through it. I mean, this is a difficult topic. And you're not going to get. I mean, I have not had the direct realization of emptiness. I can talk about it intellectually, I can describe it, but if you have, once your practice is to the point that you have a realization, a direct realization, in other words, when you view the world, you see how it exists. You see, when you look at a table, you see the forest, you see the acorn. And the sun and the water that fed that acorn, and you see the forester to cut the tree down, you see the carpenter that built it, that put that wood in that form. And so again, the five aggregates, it's just a label, it's just a label, form, feeling, compositional factors, consciousness. And the reason that these things are impermanent is because they're always changing. Our bodies are always, our form is all changing, it's aging. As we breathe, the blood going through our veins, we're decomposing, we're getting old. Everything that you see, that you experience is changing, is decomposing, is returning to whatever the cause and condition that created it. And then something else will come from that. And so this logical challenge here, the last one, if all the components of self are impermanent, and I capitalize these, then how can there be a self? If these form, feelings, compositional factors, consciousness are always changing, it's not permanent, then how can there be an Atman? In Sanskrit. So the logical conclusion is it must be an illusion. And I'm just saying it a different way here. I mean, even the aggregates that we're composed of, those are changing. They are not independent. So, I mean, this is the point of all of this. This is the point of all of this. This is the third noble truth. And I'm just saying it in a different, another way. I mean, why would you be attached to something that's that's impermanent. I mean, you think about the toys that children have. I mean, when I was a child and you get this brand new toy, it's like, man, this is the best thing that's ever been. And it lasts a week. You know, I got the wheels pulled off of it. I stepped on it and broke this and broke that. Now the dog's walking around. It's a chew toy now. I mean.
Or more for us, it's like if you got a Mercedes-Benz that's out in the parking lot, you know. I remember the day when I got my new Honda and I drove it to work. And one day I came out, you know, I really... proud of this thing, and it was just the perfect car ever. And I come out and I notice this little red scratch on the door, and it's because of this guy who had a red Corolla and he always parked next to me. And
so,
and it did affect the way I felt about the car.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
Just because I thought the car was permanent.
Absolutely.
You know? But no, it's just parts and cause and conditions, and it's impermanent. It's always changing. Everything is changing.
And a car is a great example of this idea of impermanence. And so there's this one, and I can't remember the story, the five guys, they're touching an elephant, and they all touch a different part, and so they're making this prediction, you know, how this thing exists. So you put your hand on Chris's
Honda.
So if we put it, is it the hood? We put it on the hood. Is it the car, the hood? We take the nose, take the hood off. Then we do the fender, put our hand, is this the car? And it's no, let's take the fenders off. We take the wheels off. Where's the car? We take the seats out. We take the motor out. We're looking for the car. And then eventually, if we're skillful enough, and they have this big pile of parts that used to be Chris's car, and we'll discover the car was never there.
It wasn't Chris's car. It's what we labeled it.
But we do that with everything. We do that with, and I'm a car guy. I think most guys are car guys. And I mean, so you drive it off the showroom floor. It's like, man, that smell. There's nothing like it, you know. And it's just deteriorating slowly. And most people upside down, you know, you write those checks every month. And it's like, oh, this is just burning money. But all of this, the Buddha's not saying not to enjoy life. Just the opposite. The whole purpose of this practice is to be happy. The Buddha says, from what the Buddha is teaching us, the purpose in life is to be happy. To be happy is to know how things exist, understand everything's impermanent, and serve other people. That's the source of happiness. That's what this all is all about, is understanding how things exist and developing an attitude that allows you to benefit other people, causes you to benefit other people. Yes, ma'am.
How does that affect relationships with other people?
How do you mean?
If we're not to get attached.
So,
yeah.
You have children? I bet you're attached. Huh? Are they permanent?
I hope until I leave first.
But they're not, are they? They're not permanent.
It's really hard with children because you've got a lot of love for your children, and that probably... you're not really attached to your children. You do love them. You want them to be happy, you know. You want them not to suffer. You hope that they don't ever not suffer. And you hope that they look at everybody with the same feeling that they'll enjoy those people as much, you know.
I was at another teaching, and they talked about attachment. And the way she described it, I thought was helpful. I hope it's okay if I share.
Sure.
That. And so what she said was, if you think of your favorite vacation spot, you know, the one place in the world you'd want to go, and you know you were only going to be there for like a day, she was saying like non-attachment was like if you went there and you just enjoyed every minute of it. So living in the moment rather than clinging to what tomorrow will bring, tomorrow and tomorrow. And so that's how I apply it with my children. Just enjoy and appreciate every moment you have with them.
Appreciation is the key. And that's true with all of the people that we love. Because, I mean, so our parents being older, they're going to, I mean, the reality is they're going to die before we do. And the way to view that sort of relationship is to appreciate them with you when you're with them. And this is true with all your relationships. Find what you like about a person and emphasize what you like about them, what you admire about them. And so when they're no longer with you, you can reflect on those attributes that caused you to like that person to start with. And so it's an unfair question to say, are you attached to your children? Attachment is, from this perspective, attachment is the false perception that this thing is the source of happiness. That's what they mean by attachment. So it's unfair to ask you if you're attached to your children, but to trying to make a point, that nothing is permanent. Our relationships are not permanent, and nothing that our five aggregates come into contact with is permanent. It's all impermanent and changing. George has a question.
So the purpose then of the teachings of the Dharma is to be happy.
Yes, sir.
Which is an emotion, which is one of the aggregates and is impermanent. So why is the goal of the teachings to find something that is impermanent?
Oh,
because
no,
everything is, or?
No, so you have everything that is required, everything that's needed to be happy, you already have. To be a Buddha is already there. Everything about you is everything you have available to you is all you need to be a Buddha. So it's not you're not seeking something that doesn't, you're not seeking something that's not there.
Right.
You're not seeking something that's not there. So as an example, and that's what I really would have used in the on mind. This is an example. The mind is clear, reflective, and this is the way your mind exists normally. This is the way it exists. All these thoughts, all these discriminations where you like some things, you don't like other things. So it's like this. And then you add these obscurations, these ideas that things exist the way they appear that they do. And then this is what you add. So that's where we are. Before, and so the dirt in here is not part of the water. It's not inherent to the water. The way your mind, your consciousness exists is clear. And so with these obscurations is how, it's what's preventing you from being, if you're not happy, this is what's preventing you from being happy. Your illusions, your delusions, your hallucinations, your attachments. Yes, ma'am.
So happiness and love is eternal. It's always been there. I mean, like the real...
I didn't mean to sigh so loud. So... No, I mean, we're not saying that at all. I don't know if that's true. From the Buddhist perspective, happiness is the wish for someone to be, love is the wish for someone to be, a person to be happy. So, and that brings up this example. So do you love your significant other, do you love them because they make you happy? In Buddhism, if you love someone, it's because you wish them to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So if that person, your significant other, could only be happy if separated from you, They can only be happy if they go away from you. Would you be happy about that?
Well, I know I'm supposed to be.
No. Yeah. But I mean, that's how severe this can be. So when you ask, you know, is love and happiness universal? I mean, whoever asked that.
Yeah, well, I think it was kind of coming off his question about happiness. So the definition of happy
is not an emotional response. Yeah. It's an intention.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think Geshe Gallant always says that, you know, like,
our goal isn't to seek happiness and impermanence. It's to realize the true nature of things.
And what you do, you would be, and it's blissful.
Well,
I mean, and in the absence of clinging, it's going to be bliss. I mean, it's just, so it's not like when you say happiness is an emotion, I think conventionally, but if you exist to benefit other beings, I mean, that's what bodhicitta is. That's what Mahayana Buddhism is your practice, your existence is to benefit others. Mother Teresa, Gandhi, Jesus Christ, I mean, who Martin Luther King, I mean, who suffered to benefit other people? I mean, that's what they're saying. That's what the Buddha is saying. That's what these teachings are saying. If you do all of that, the natural result is going to be happiness. Jimmy, you want to add anything?
No, I think, you know, Mother Teresa, I think, is a good example.
Yeah.
You know, that's what she did. That's how she devoted her whole life.
Yeah. In Calcutta, of all places. Yeah.
Because she wasn't concerned about herself. She was concerned about others.
Well, selflessness.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Heidi, you want to add anything? Eddie. I'm sorry. I mispronounce your name all the time. I'm sorry. We're going to India, Eddie and I, in October, November. Going to Sarah J. Monastery, going to Bodh Gaya, get some enlightenment.
I got to tell my sappy story.
Tell it.
Okay. This is one of those things that, anyway, hey, here's what happened. I'm in our upstairs back bedroom one hot summer afternoon, lying on the bed, and I'm, you know, having a hard time taking a nap because it's so hot and miserable upstairs in the back bedroom. And I wake up, or I go to get up, and I don't know what happened, but I just realized right then that every part of me came from something else. And I was, here comes a goofy part, but I was on like this total bliss kick for 2 weeks. I couldn't come down off of this. It was just like total happiness. Just realizing that every part of me depends on something else. Most of which were living beings, you know. And that's it.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you.
I know it sounds goofy, but... And I told that to Venerable Rabina, because I went over to help her with her iPod or something, and I told this to her, and there were just like two beats like you hear, see in a movie, and then it was just, she just almost cried looking at me. Again, that sounds sappy, but she realized that I had one of these glimpses of emptiness, and the way I described it, I was just totally blissed out.
Yes, ma'am.
It's almost like, so you were saying everything's connected, interconnected. It's like the emptiness is almost allness. Like, it's everything.
Oh, and it's true about it. Even emptiness is empty.
Yeah, but it's just like, but it's all, that equate it with just everything.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, I mean, here's an example. I mean, so we look up in the sky, and there's no distinction. East and west, north and south, it's not marked up there. But, I mean, we act like it's true. We act like it's like there's really an east, there's really a west. I mean, conventionally it is. And so this last slide is, I mean, And this is what I got from Geshe Tasha Searing. This is why we study this. I mean, we all discriminate in one way or other in the foods, in colors. You know, we like this color and that one likes that color. We like this kind of food and so on and so on and so on and so on. So we all have these discriminations. But when you examine things with this view of emptiness and you get down to the subatomic level, it's all the same. That's what Chris was talking about. We are all atoms of nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and not helium. What is the other one? Oxygen, carbon. But maybe. But I mean, when you get down to that to that level, it's all the same. It's the same as the tree. No, I'm not saying we're trees, but I'm saying we are all exist because of a prior causing condition, and we're made of the same stuff.
Right. Don't go all the way to nihilism. There is a conventional Chris here. It's just that when you guys look at me, you might be enlightened. I don't know that because I can't. You might be enlightened. You're just here to help me understand emptiness. But if you understand emptiness, you'll see all the parts of me that came together to make me, you know, my dependent arising.
His parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. Yeah. Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, well, that makes sense with the Big Bang Theory. You know, everything came out of nothing, and we're all part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know.
Yeah, there's no new matter.
Yeah, exactly.
There's new matter. New matter. It's just changing. It's just changing.
But like I said, in Buddhism, the universe always was. So it might not have been the first Big Bang, you know. That's right. That's what.
It helps me understand it a little bit more.
Right. Yeah, right.
So what is the Buddhist concept of time?
Kalachakra. So there's two, and this is not part of Buddhism in a nutshell. That's a very advanced.
Should I wait?
No, I mean, but
when there's time.
But Kalachakra, it's the wheel of time. I mean, it's like there's always been, our philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy, is in line with modern physics. If you go fast enough, you're going to meet yourself. But that's way beyond my
time. I think we look at it as a non-compositional factor. Like, there had to be some time between all the events that came together and the parts and causes and conditions for that pillow. So it's like, it's a, how do they put it? A compositional factor. A non-physical compositional factor.
Yeah. Yep. It's at 8:30. Thank you all for coming. I'm so amazed y'all come back. You know, when I see a familiar face, I'm like, oh, they came back. I didn't scare them off, or I was so boring they would have found something else to do.
Did your mind settle it all?
I don't know. It will. But some people, like George, takes these classes over again. I would take this class over again. I'd go to the meditation class. We still talk about all these topics, discovering Buddhism, the books we have out here. Everyone here is a student. Is a teacher or a student? Some are better than others. I'm like a C-minus student. So this gives you some idea what your karma has been like. That you only get a C-minus student as a teacher. But I mean, this is a great community, and just anybody here would be willing to talk with you and help you with things.
Thank you.
Happy to have you. Thank you for all for coming. Anything else, Chris, Jim?